turning, holding tightly to the wheel with one hand, leaning forward. It's happened. This was bad. The others, at this, cried still harder, holding on to each other, forgetting the newspapers, letting the rain fall and mingle with their tears. Hernando stiffened. He put the rest of the water into the radiator. He looked at the sky, which was black with storm. He looked at the river rushing. He felt the asphalt under his shoes. He came to the side of the car. The young man took his hand and gave him a peso. No, Hernando gave it back. It is my pleasure.
Thank you. You're so kind, said one of the girls, still sobbing. Oh, Mama, Papa. Oh, I want to be home. I want to be home. Oh, Mama, Dad.
And others held her.
I did not hear, Señor, said Hernando quietly.
The war! Shouted the young man, as if no one could hear. It's come! The Atom War, the end of the world!
Señor, Señor, said Hernando.
Thank you for your help.
Goodbye, said the young man.
Goodbye,
they all said in the rain, not seeing him. He stood while the car engaged its gears and rattled off down, fading away through the valley. Finally it was gone, with the young women in it, the last car, the newspapers held and fluttered over their heads. Hernando did not move for a long time. The rain ran very cold down his cheeks and along his fingers and into the woven garment on his legs. He held his breath, waiting, tight and tensed. He watched the highway, but it did not move again. He doubted that it would move much for a very long time. The rain stopped. The sky broke through the clouds. In 10 minutes the storm was gone like a bad breath. A sweet wind blew the smell of the jungle up to him. He could hear the river moving gently and easily on its way. The jungle was very green. Everything was fresh. He walked down through the field to his house and picked up his plow. With his hands on it, he looked at the sky beginning to burn hot with the sun. His wife called out from her work.
What happened, Hernando?
It is nothing, he replied.
He set the plow in the furrow. He called sharply to his burro.
Burro!
And they walked together through the rich field, under the clearing sky, on their tilled land by the deep river.
What do they mean? The world, he said.
The Man. Captain Hart stood in the door of the rocket.
Why don't they come? He said.
Who knows? Said Martin, his lieutenant. Do I know, Captain?
What kind of a place is this, anyway?
The captain lighted a cigarette. He tossed the match out into the glittering meadow. The grass started to burn. Martin moved to stamp it out with his boot.
No, ordered Captain Hart. Let it burn. Maybe they'll come see what's happening then. The ignorant fools.
Martin shrugged and withdrew his foot from the spreading fire. Captain Hart examined his watch.
An hour ago we landed here. And does the welcoming committee rush out with a brass band to shake our hands? No, indeed. Here we ride millions of miles through space, and the fine citizens of some silly town on some unknown planet ignore us.
He snorted, tapping his watch.
Well, I'll just give them 5 more minutes, and then...
And then what? Asked Martin, ever so politely, watching the captain's jowls shake.
We'll fly over their damned city again and scare the hell out of them.
His voice grew quieter.
Do you think, Martin, maybe they didn't see us land?
They saw us. They looked up as we flew over.
Then why aren't they running across the field? Are they hiding? Are they yellow?
Martin shook his head. No. Take these binoculars, sir. See for yourself.
Everybody's walking around.
They're not frightened. They... well, they just don't seem to care. Captain Hart placed the binoculars to his tired eyes. Martin looked up and had time to observe the lines and the grooves of irritation, tiredness, nervousness there. Hart looked a million years old. He never slept, he ate little, and drove himself on, on. Now his mouth moved, aged and rear, but sharp, under the held binoculars.
"Really, Martin, I don't know why we bother. We build rockets, we go to all the trouble of crossing space, searching for them, and this is what we get. Neglect. Look at those idiots wander about in there. Don't they realize how big this is? The first space flight to touch their provincial land? How many times does that happen? Are they that blasé?"
Martin didn't know. Captain Hart gave him back the binoculars wearily.
"Why do we do it, Martin? This space travel, I mean. Always on the go, always searching. Our insides always tight, never any rest.
Maybe we're looking for peace and quiet. Certainly there's none on Earth," said Martin.
"No, there's not, is there?"
Captain Hart was thoughtful. The fire damped down.
"Not since Darwin, eh? Not since everything went by the board, everything we used to believe in, eh? Divine power and all that? And so you think maybe that's why we're going out to the stars, eh, Martin? Looking for our lost souls. Is that it? Trying to get away from our evil planet to a good one?"
"Perhaps, sir. Certainly we're looking for something." Captain Hart cleared his throat and tightened back into sharpness.
"Well, right now we're looking for the mayor of that city there. Run in. Tell them who we are. The first rocket expedition to Planet 43 in Star System 3. Captain Hart sends his salutations and desires to meet the mayor. On the double!"
"Yes, sir." Martin walked slowly across the meadow.
"Hurry!" snapped the captain.
"Yes, sir." Martin trotted away. Then he walked again, smiling to himself. The captain had smoked two cigars before Martin returned. Martin stopped and looked up into the door of the rocket, swaying, seemingly unable to focus his eyes or think.
"Well," snapped Hart, "what happened? Are they coming to welcome us?"
"No." Martin had to lean dizzily against the ship.
"Why not?"
"It's not important," said Martin. "Give me a cigarette, please, Captain." His fingers groped blindly at the rising pack, for he was looking at the Golden City and blinking. He lighted one and smoked quietly for a long time.
"Say something," cried the captain. "Aren't they interested in our rocket?"
Martin said, "What? Oh, the rocket?" He inspected his cigarette. "No, they're not interested. Seems we came at an inopportune time."
"Inopportune time?"
Martin was patient. "Captain, listen. Something big happened yesterday in that city. It's so big. So important that we're second rate, second fiddle. I've got to sit down." He lost his balance and sat heavily, gasping for air. The captain chewed his cigar angrily.
"What happened?"
Martin lifted his head, smoke from the burning cigarette in his fingers, blowing in the wind. "Sir, yesterday in that city a remarkable man appeared. Good, intelligent, compassionate, and infinitely wise." The captain glared at his lieutenant.
"What's that to do with us?"
"It's hard to explain. But he was a man for whom they'd waited a long time, a million years maybe, and yesterday he walked into their city. That's why today, sir, our rocket landing means nothing." The captain sat down violently.
Who was it? Not Ashley. He didn't arrive in his rocket before us and steal my glory, did he?
He seized Martin's arm. His face was pale and dismayed. Not Ashley, sir.
Then it was Burton. I knew it. Burton stole in ahead of us and ruined my landing. You can't trust anyone anymore.
Not Burton either, sir, said Martin quietly. The captain was incredulous.
There were only three rockets. We were in the lead. This man who got here ahead of us, what was his name?
He didn't have a name. He doesn't need one. It would be different on every planet, sir. The captain stared at his lieutenant with hard, cynical eyes.
Well, what did he do that was so wonderful that nobody even looks at our ship?
For one thing, said Martin steadily, he healed the sick and comforted the poor. He fought hypocrisy and dirty politics and sat among the people talking through the day.
Is that so wonderful?
Yes, Captain.
I don't get this.
The captain confronted Martin, peered into his face and eyes.
You been drinking, eh?
He was suspicious. He backed away.
I don't understand.
Martin looked at the city. Captain, if you don't understand, there's no way of telling you. The captain followed his gaze. The city was quiet and beautiful, and a great peace lay over it. The captain stepped forward, taking his cigar from his lips. He squinted first at Martin, then at the golden spires of the buildings.
You don't mean... You can't mean... That man you're talking about couldn't be...
Martin nodded. That's what I mean, sir. The captain stood silently, not moving. He drew himself up.
I don't believe it, he said at last.
At high noon, Captain Hart walked briskly into the city, accompanied by Lieutenant Martin and an assistant who was carrying some electrical equipment. Every once in a while, the captain laughed loudly, put his hands on his hips, and shook his head. The mayor of the town confronted him. Martin set up a tripod, screwed a box onto it, and switched on the batteries.
Are you the mayor?
The captain jabbed a finger out.
I am, said the mayor.
The delicate apparatus stood between them, controlled and adjusted by Martin and the assistant. Instantaneous translation from any language were made by the box. The words sounded crisply on the mild air of the city.
About this occurrence yesterday, said the captain. It occurred?
It did.
You have witnesses?
We have.
May we talk to them?
Talk to any of us, said the mayor. We are all witnesses.
In an aside to Martin, the captain said,
Mass hallucination.
To the mayor.
What did this man, this stranger, look like?
That would be hard to say, said the mayor, smiling a little.
Why would it?
Opinions might differ slightly.
I'd like your opinion, sir, anyway, said the captain. Record this,
he snapped to Martin over his shoulder. The lieutenant pressed the button of a hand recorder.
Well, said the mayor of the city, he was a very gentle and kind man. He was of a great and knowing intelligence.
Yes, yes, I know, the captain waved his fingers. Generalizations! I want something specific! What did he look like?
I don't believe that is important, replied the mayor.
It's very important, said the captain sternly. I want a description of this fellow. If I can't get it from you, I'll get it from others.
To Martin,
I'm sure it must have been Burton pulling one of his practical jokes.
Martin would not look him in the face. Martin was coldly silent. The captain snapped his fingers.
There was something or other, a healing.
"Many healings," said the mayor.
"May I see one?"
"You may," said the mayor. "My son." He nodded at a small boy who stepped forward. "He was afflicted with a withered arm. Now, look upon it."
At this the captain laughed tolerantly.
"Yes, yes. This isn't even circumstantial evidence, you know. I didn't see the boy's withered arm. I see only his arm whole and well. That's no proof. What proof have you that the boy's arm was withered yesterday and today as well?"
"My word is my proof," said the mayor simply.
"My dear man," cried the captain, "you don't expect me to go on hearsay, do you? Oh, no."
"I'm sorry," said the mayor, looking upon the captain with what appeared to be curiosity and pity.
"Do you have any pictures of the boy before today?" asked the captain.
After a moment, a large oil portrait was carried forth, showing the son with a withered arm.
"My dear fellow,"
the captain waved it away,
"anybody can paint a picture. Paintings lie. I want a photograph of the boy."
There was no photograph. Photography was not a known art in their society.
"Well," sighed the captain, face twitching, "let me talk to a few other citizens. We're getting nowhere."
He pointed at a woman.
"You!"
She hesitated.
"Yes, you, come here," ordered the captain. "Tell me about this wonderful man you saw yesterday."
The woman looked steadily at the captain.
"He walked among us and was very fine and good."
"What color were his eyes?"
"The color of the sun, the color of the sea, the color of a flower, the color of the mountains, the color of the night."
"That'll do."
The captain threw up his hands.
"See, Martin, absolutely nothing. Some charlatan wanders through whispering sweet nothings in their ears and—" "Please stop it," said Martin.
The captain stepped back.
"What?"
"You heard what I said," said Martin. "I like these people. I believe what they say. You're entitled to your opinion, but keep it to yourself, sir."
"You can't talk to me this way," shouted the captain.
"I've had enough of your high-handedness," replied Martin. "Leave these people alone. They've got something good and decent, and you come and foul up the nest and sneer at it. Well, I've talked to them, too. I've gone through the city and seen their faces. And they've got something you'll never have, a little simple faith, and they'll move mountains with it. You're boiled because someone stole your act, got here ahead and made you unimportant."
"I'll give you 5 seconds to finish," remarked the captain. "I understand you've been under a strain, Martin. Months of traveling in space, nostalgia, loneliness, and now with this thing happening, I sympathize, Martin. I overlook your petty insubordination." "I don't overlook your petty tyranny," replied Martin. "I'm stepping out. I'm staying here." "You can't do that."
"Can't I? Try and stop me. This is what I came looking for. I didn't know it, but this is it. This is for me. Take your filth somewhere else and foul up other nests with your doubt and your scientific method."
He looked swiftly about.
"These people have had an experience, and you can't seem to get it through your head that it's really happened, and we were lucky enough to almost arrive in time to be in on it. People on Earth have talked about this man for 20 centuries after he walked through the old world. We've all wanted to see him and hear him, and never had the chance. And now, today, we just missed seeing him by a few hours."
Captain Hart looked at Martin's cheeks.
"You're crying like a baby. Stop it."
"I don't care."
"Well, I do. In front of these natives, we're to keep up a front. You're overwrought. As I said, I forgive you."
"I don't want your forgiveness."
"You idiot. Can't you see this is one of Burton's tricks, to fool these people, to bilk them, to establish his oil and mineral concerns under a religious guise? You fool, Martin! You absolute fool! You should know Earthmen by now. They'll do anything. Blaspheme, lie, cheat, steal, kill, to get their ends. Anything is fine if it works. The true pragmatist, that's Burton. You know him! The captain scoffed heavily. Come off it, Martin, admit it. This is the sort of scaly thing Burton might carry off. Polish up these citizens and pluck them when they're ripe.
No, said Martin, thinking of it.
The captain put his hands up.
That's Burton.
That's him.
That's his dirt. That's his criminal way. I have to admire the old dragon, flaming in here in a blaze and a halo and a soft word and a loving touch, with a medicated salve here and a healing ray there. That's Burton, all right.
No.
Martin's voice was dazed. He covered his eyes.
No. I won't believe it.
You don't want to believe.
Captain Hart kept at it.
Admit it now. Admit it. It's just the thing Burton would do. Stop daydreaming, Martin. Wake up. It's morning. This is a real world, and we're real. Dirty people. Burton, the dirtiest of us all.
Martin turned away.
There, there, Martin,
said Hart, mechanically patting the man's back.
I understand. Quite a shock for you, I know. A rotten shame and all that. That Burton is a rascal. You go take it easy. Let me handle this.
Martin walked off slowly toward the rocket. Captain Hart watched him go. Then, taking a deep breath, he turned to the woman he had been questioning.
Well, tell me some more about this man. As you were saying, madam?
Later, the officers of the rocket ship ate supper on card tables outside. The captain correlated his data to a silent Martin who sat red-eyed and brooding over his meal.
Interviewed 3 dozen people, all of them full of the same milk and hogwash, said the captain. It's Burton's work, all right, I'm positive. He'll be spilling back in here tomorrow or next week to consolidate his miracles and beat us out in our contracts. I think I'll stick on and spoil it for him.
Martin glanced up sullenly.
I'll kill him, he said.
Now, now, Martin. There, there, boy.
I'll kill him. So help me, I will.
We'll put an anchor on his wagon. You have to admit he's clever. Unethical, but clever.
He's dirty.
You must promise not to do anything violent.
Captain Hart checked his figures.
According to this, there were 30 miracles of healing performed, a blind man restored to vision, a leper cured. Oh, Burton's efficient, give him that.
A gong sounded. A moment later, a man ran up.
Captain, sir, a report. Burton's ship is coming down. Also the Ashley ship, sir.
See? Captain Hart beat the table. Here come the jackals to the harvest. They can't wait to feed. Wait till I confront them. I'll make them cut me in on this feast. I will.
Martin looked sick. He stared at the captain.
Business, my dear boy, business, said the captain.
Everybody looked up. 2 rockets swung down out of the sky. When the rockets landed, they almost crashed.
What's wrong with those fools? Cried the captain, jumping up.
The men ran across the meadowlands to the steaming ships. The captain arrived. The airlock door popped open on Burton's ship. A man fell out into their arms.
"What's wrong?"
cried Hart. The man lay on the ground. They bent over him, and he was burned, badly burned. His body was covered with wounds and scars and tissue that was inflamed and smoking. He looked up out of puffed eyes, and his thick tongue moved in his split lips.
"What happened?"
demanded the captain, kneeling down, shaking the man's arm.
"Sir, sir,"
whispered the dying man.
48 hours ago, back in Space Sector 79 DFS, off Planet One in this system, our ship and Ashley's ship ran into a cosmic storm, sir."
Liquid ran gray from the man's nostrils. Blood trickled from his mouth.
"Wiped out. All crew. Burton dead. Ashley died an hour ago. Only 3 survivals."
"Listen to me," shouted Hart, bending over the bleeding man. "You didn't come to this planet before this very hour."
Silence.
"Answer me," cried Hart.
The dying man said,
"No. Storm. Burton dead 2 days ago. This first landing on any world in 6 months."
"Are you sure?"
shouted Hart, shaking violently, gripping the man in his hands.
"Are you sure?"
"Sure. Sure,"
mouthed the dying man.
"Burton died 2 days ago. You're positive?"
"Yes. Yes,"
whispered the man. His head fell forward. The man was dead. The captain knelt beside the silent body. The captain's face twitched, the muscles jerking involuntarily. The other members of the crew stood back of him, looking down. Martin waited. The captain asked to be helped to his feet, finally, and this was done. They stood looking at the city.
"That means..."
"That means," said Martin,
"we're the only ones who've been here,"
whispered Captain Hart.
"And that man..."
"What about that man, Captain?" asked Martin. The captain's face twitched senselessly. He looked very old indeed and gray. His eyes were glazed. He moved forward in the dry grass.
"Come along, Martin. Come along.
Hold me up.
For my sake, hold me.
I'm afraid I'll fall. And hurry. We can't waste time."
They moved, stumbling toward the city, in the long dry grass, in the blowing wind. Several hours later, they were sitting in the mayor's auditorium. 1,000 people had come and talked and gone. The captain had remained seated, his face haggard, listening, listening. There was so much light in the faces of those who came and testified and talked, he could not bear to see them. And all the while his hands traveled, on his knees, together, on his belt, jerking and quivering. When it was over, Captain Hart turned to the mayor and, with strange eyes, said,
"But you must know where he went."
"He didn't say where he was going," replied the mayor.
"To one of the other nearby worlds?" demanded the captain.
"I don't know."
"You must know."
"Do you see him?" asked the mayor, indicating the crowd. The captain looked.
"No."
"Then he is probably gone," said the mayor.
"Probably? Probably,"
cried the captain weakly.
"I've made a horrible mistake, and I want to see him now. Why
It just came to me. This is the most unusual thing in history. To be in on something like this. Why, the chances are one in billions we've arrived at one certain planet among millions of planets the day after he came. You must know where he's gone.
Each finds him in his own way, replied the mayor gently.
You're hiding him!
The captain's face grew slowly ugly. Some of the old hardness returned in stages. He began to stand up. No, said the mayor.
You know where he is, then?
The captain's fingers twitched at the leather holster on his right side. I couldn't tell you where he is exactly, said the mayor.
I advise you to start talking.
And the captain took out a small steel gun. There's no way, said the mayor, to tell you anything.
Liar!
An expression of pity came into the mayor's face as he looked at Hart. You're very tired, he said. You've traveled a long way, and you belong to a tired people who've been without faith a long time, and you want to believe so much now that you're interfering with yourself. You'll only make it harder if you kill. You'll never find him that way.
Where'd he go? He told you. You know. Come on. Tell me.
The captain waved the gun. The mayor shook his head.
Tell me! Tell me!
The gun cracked once, twice. The mayor fell, his arm wounded. Martin leaped forward.
Captain!
The gun flashed at Martin.
Don't interfere!
On the floor, holding his wounded arm, the mayor looked up. Put down your gun. You're hurting yourself. You've never believed, and now that you think you believe, you hurt people because of it.
I don't need you, said Hart, standing over him. If I missed him by one day here, I'll go on to another world, and another. I'll miss him by half a day on the next planet. Maybe. And a quarter of a day on the third planet. And 2 hours on the next. And an hour on the next. And a half an hour on the next, and a minute on the next, but after that one day I'll catch up with him. Do you hear that?
He was shouting now, leaning wearily over the man on the floor. He staggered with exhaustion.
Come along, Martin.
He let the gun hang in his hand. No, said Martin. I'm staying here.
You're a fool. Stay if you like. But I'm going on with the others, as far as I can go.
The mayor looked up at Martin. I'll be all right. Leave me. Others will tend my wounds. I'll be back, said Martin. I'll walk as far as the rocket. They walked with vicious speed through the city. One could see with what effort the captain struggled to show all the old iron, to keep himself going. When he reached the rocket, he slapped the side of it with a trembling hand. He holstered his gun. He looked at Martin.
Well, Martin.
Martin looked at him. Well, Captain? The captain's eyes were on the sky.
Sure you won't. Come with. With me, eh?
No, sir.
It'll be a great adventure, by God. I know I'll find him.
You are set on it now, aren't you, sir? Asked Martin. The captain's face quivered and his eyes closed.
Yes.
There's one thing I'd like to know.
What?
Sir, when you find him, if you find him, asked Martin, what will you ask of him?
Why?
The captain faltered, opening his eyes, his hands clenched and unclenched. He puzzled a moment and then broke into a strange smile.
Why, I'll ask him for a little peace and quiet.
He touched the rocket.
It's been a long time. A long, long time since I've relaxed.
Did you ever just try, Captain?
I don't understand, said Hart.
Never mind. So long, Captain.
Goodbye, Mr. Martin.
The crew stood by the port. Out of their number, only three were going on with Hart. Seven others were remaining behind, they said, with Martin. Captain Hart surveyed them and uttered his verdict.
Fools!
He, last of all, climbed into the airlock, gave a brisk salute, laughed sharply. The door slammed. The rocket lifted into the sky on a pillar of fire. Martin watched it go far away and vanish. At the meadow's edge, the mayor, supported by several men, beckoned. He's gone, said Martin, walking up.
Yes, poor man, he's gone, said the mayor. And he'll go on, planet after planet, seeking and seeking, and always he will be an hour late, or a half hour late, or 10 minutes late, or a minute late. And finally, he will miss out by only a few seconds. And when he has visited 300 worlds and is 70 or 80 years old, he will miss out by only a fraction of a second, and then a smaller fraction of a second. And he will go on and on, thinking to find that very thing which he left behind here, on this planet, in this city.
Martin looked steadily at the mayor. The mayor put out his hand.
Was there ever any doubt of it?
He beckoned to the others and turned.
Come along now. We mustn't keep him waiting.
They walked into the city.
The long rain. The rain continued. It was a hard rain, a perpetual rain, a sweating and steaming rain. It was a mizzle, a downpour, a fountain, a whipping at the eyes, an undertow at the ankles. It was a rain to drown all rains and the memory of rains. It came by the pound and the ton. It hacked at the jungle and cut the trees like scissors and shaved the grass and tunneled the soil and molted the bushes. It shrank men's hands into hands of wrinkled apes. It rained a solid, glassy rain, and it never stopped.
How much farther, Lieutenant?
I don't know. 1 mile, 10 miles, 1,000.
Aren't you sure?
How can I be sure?
I don't like this rain. If we only knew how far it is to the Sun Dome, I'd feel better.
1 hour or 2 from here.
You really think so, Lieutenant?
Of course.
Or are you lying to keep us happy?
I'm lying to keep you happy. Shut up! The two men sat together in the rain. Behind them sat two other men, who were wet and tired and slumped like clay that was melting. The lieutenant looked up. He had a face that once had been brown, and now the rain had washed it pale, and the rain had washed the color from his eyes, and they were white, as were his teeth, and as was his hair.
He was all white. Even his uniform was beginning to turn white, and perhaps a little green with fungus. The lieutenant felt the rain on his cheeks. How many million years since the rain stopped raining here on Venus?
Don't be crazy, said one of the two other men. It never stops raining on Venus. It just goes on and on. I've lived here for 10 years, and I never saw a minute or even a second when it wasn't pouring.
It's like living under water, said the lieutenant, and rose up, shrugging his gums into place.
Well, we'd better get going. We'll find that sun dome yet.
Or we won't find it, said the cynic.
It's an hour or so.
Now you're lying to me, lieutenant.
No, now I'm lying to myself. This is one of those times when you've got to lie. I can't take much more of this.
They walked down the jungle trail, now and then looking at their compasses. There was no direction anywhere, only what the compass said. There was a gray sky and rain falling and jungle and a path, and far back behind them somewhere, a rocket in which they had ridden and fallen. A rocket in which lay two of their friends, dead and dripping rain. They walked in single file, not speaking. They came to a river which lay wide and flat and brown, flowing down to the great single sea. The surface of it was stippled in a billion places by the rain.
All right, Simmons.
The lieutenant nodded, and Simmons took a small packet from his back, which, with the pressure of hidden chemical, inflated into a large boat. The lieutenant directed the cutting of wood and the quick making of paddles, and they set out into the river, paddling swiftly across the smooth surface in the rain. The lieutenant felt the cold rain on his cheeks and on his neck and on his moving arms. The cold was beginning to seep into his lungs. He felt the rain on his ears, on his eyes, on his legs.
I didn't sleep last night, he said.
Who could? Who has? When? How many nights have we slept? 30 nights, 30 days. Who can sleep with rain slamming their head, banging away? I'd give anything for a hat. Anything at all, just so it wouldn't hit my head anymore. I get headaches. My head is sore. It hurts all the time.
I'm sorry I came to China, said one of the others.
First time I ever heard Venus called China.
Sure, China. Chinese water cure. Remember the old torture? Rope you against a wall, drop one drop of water on your head every half hour. You go crazy waiting for the next one.
Well, that's Venus, but on a big scale.
We're not made for water. You can't sleep, you can't breathe right, and you're crazy from just being soggy. If we'd been ready for a crash, we'd have brought waterproof uniforms and hats. It's this beating rain on your head gets you most of all. It's so heavy. It's like BB shots. I don't know how long I can take it.
Boy, me for the sun dome. The man who thought them up thought of something.
They crossed the river, and in crossing they thought of the sun dome, somewhere ahead of them, shining in the jungle rain. A yellow house, round and bright as the sun. A house 15 feet high by 100 feet in diameter, in which was warmth and quiet and hot food and freedom from rain. And in the center of the sun dome, of course, was a sun. A small floating free globe of yellow fire drifting in a space at the top of the building where you could look at it from where you sat, smoking or reading a book or drinking your hot chocolate crowned with marshmallow dollops. There it would be, the yellow sun, just the size of the Earth sun. And it was warm and continuous. And the rain world of Venus would be forgotten as long as they stayed in that house and idled their time. The lieutenant turned and looked back at the three men using their oars and gritting their teeth. They were as white as mushrooms, as white as he was. Venus bleached everything away in a few months. Even the jungle was an immense cartoon nightmare, for how could the jungle be green with no sun, with always rain falling and always dusk? The white, white jungle with the pale cheese-colored leaves, and the earth carved of wet camembert, and the tree boles, like
immense toadstools, everything black and white. And how often could you see the soil itself? Wasn't it mostly a creek, a stream, a puddle, a pool, a lake, a river? And then, at last, the sea? Here we are! They leaped out on the farthest shore, splashing and sending up showers. The boat was deflated and stored in a cigarette packet. Then, standing on the rainy shore, they tried to light up a few smokes for themselves, and it was 5 minutes or so before, shuddering, they worked the inverted lighter and, cupping their hands, managed a few drags upon cigarettes that all too quickly were limp and beaten away from their lips by a sudden slap of rain. They walked on.
"Wait just a moment," said the lieutenant. "I thought I saw something ahead.
The sun dome?
I'm not sure." The rain closed in again. Simmons began to run.
"The sun dome!
Come back, Simmons!
The sun dome!"
Simmons vanished in the rain. The others ran after him. They found him in a little clearing, and they stopped and looked at him and what he had discovered. The rocket ship. It was laying where they had left it. Somehow they had circled back and were where they had started. In the ruin of the ship, green fungus was growing up out of the mouths of the two dead men. As they watched, the fungus took flower. The petals broke away in the rain, and the fungus died.
How did we do it?
An electrical storm must be nearby. Threw our compasses off. That explains it.
You're right. What'll we do now?
Start out again.
Good Lord, we're not any closer to anywhere.
Let's try to keep calm about it, Simmons.
Calm? Calm? This rain's driving me wild.
We've enough food for another 2 days if we're careful.
The rain danced on their skin, on their wet uniforms. The rain streamed from their noses and ears, from their fingers and knees. They looked like stone fountains, frozen in the jungle, issuing forth water from every pore. And as they stood from a distance, they heard a roar, and the monster came out of the rain. The monster was supported upon 1,000 electric blue legs. It walked swiftly and terribly. It struck down a leg with a driving blow. Everywhere a leg struck, a tree fell and burned. Great whiffs of ozone filled the rainy air, and smoke blew away and was broken up by the rain. The monster was a half mile wide and a mile high, and it felt of the ground like a great blind thing. Sometimes, for a moment, it had no legs at all. And then, in an instant, 1,000 whips would fall out of its belly, white-blue whips, to sting the jungle.
"There's the electrical storm," said one of the men. "There's a thing ruined our compasses. And it's coming this way."
"Lie down, everyone," said the lieutenant.
"Run!"
cried Simmons. "Don't be a fool. Lie down. It hits the highest points. We may get through unhurt. Lie down about 50 feet from the rocket. It may very well spend its force there and leave us be. Get down."
The men flopped.
"Is it coming?"
they asked each other after a moment.
"Coming."
"Is it nearer?"
200 yards off."
"Nearer?"
"Here she is."
The monster came and stood over them. It dropped down 10 blue bolts of lightning, which struck the rocket. The rocket flashed like a beaten gong and gave off a metal ringing. The monster let down 15 more bolts, which danced about in a ridiculous pantomime, feeling of the jungle and the watery soil.
"No, no!"
one of the men jumped up.
"Get down, you fool!" said the lieutenant.
"No!"
The lightning struck the rocket another dozen times. The lieutenant turned his head on his arm and saw the blue blazing flashes. He saw trees split and crumple into ruin. He saw the monstrous dark cloud turn like a black disk overhead and hurl down 100 other poles of electricity. The man who had leapt up was now running, like someone in a great hall of pillars. He ran and dodged between the pillars, and then at last 12 of the pillars slammed down, and there was the sound a fly makes when landing upon the grill wires of an exterminator. The lieutenant remembered this from his childhood on a farm.
and there was a smell of a man burned to a cinder. The lieutenant lowered his head.
"Don't look up," he told the others.
He was afraid that he, too, might run at any moment. The storm above them flashed down another series of bolts and then moved on away. Once again there was only the rain, which rapidly cleared the air of the charred smell, and in a moment the three remaining men were sitting and waiting for the beat of their hearts to subside into quiet once more. They walked over to the body, thinking that perhaps they could still save the man's life. They couldn't believe that there wasn't some way to help the man. It was the natural act of men who have not accepted death until they have touched it and turned it over and made plans to bury it or leave it there for the jungle to bury in an hour of quick growth. The body was twisted steel, wrapped in burned leather. It looked like a wax dummy that had been thrown into an incinerator and pulled out after the wax had sunk to the charcoal skeleton. Only the teeth were white, and they shone like a strange white bracelet dropped half through a clenched black fist. "He shouldn't have jumped up," they said it almost at the same time. Even as they stood over the body, it began to vanish, for the vegetation was edging in upon it, little vines and ivy and creepers and even flowers for the dead. At a distance, the storm walked off on blue bolts of lightning and was gone. They crossed a river and a creek and a stream and a dozen other rivers and creeks and streams. Before their eyes, rivers appeared, rushing, new rivers, while old rivers changed their courses, rivers the color of mercury, rivers the color of silver and milk. They came to the sea, the single sea. There was only one continent on Venus. This land was 3,000 miles long by 1,000 miles wide, and about this island was the single sea, which covered the entire reigning planet. The single sea which lay upon the pallid shore with little motion. "This way," the lieutenant nodded south. "I'm sure there are two sun domes down that way."
"While they were at it, why didn't they build 100 more? There's 120 of them now, aren't there?"
126 as of last month. They tried to push a bill through Congress back on Earth a year ago to provide for a couple dozen more, but oh no, you know how that is. They'd rather a few men went crazy with the rain." They started south. The lieutenant and Simmons and the third man, Pickard, walked in the rain. In the rain that fell heavily and lightly, heavily and lightly. In the rain that poured and hammered and did not stop falling upon the land and the sea and the walking people. Simmons saw it first.
"There it is!"
"There's what?"
"The sun dome!"
The lieutenant blinked the water from his eyes and raised his hands to ward off the stinging blows of the rain. At a distance there was a yellow glow on the edge of the jungle by the sea. It was, indeed, the sun dome. The men smiled at each other.
"Looks like you were right, Lieutenant. Luck. Brother, that puts muscle in me, just seeing it. Come on, last one there's a son of a bitch."
Simmons began to trot. The others automatically fell in with this, gasping, tired, but keeping pace.
"A big pot of coffee for me,"
panted Simmons, smiling.
"And a pan of cinnamon buns, by God, and just lie there and let the old sun hit you. The guy that invented the sun domes, he should have got a medal."
They ran faster. The yellow glow grew brighter.
"Guess a lot of men went crazy before they figured out the cure. Think it'd be obvious, right off,"
Simmons panted, the words in cadence to his running.
"Rain, rain, years ago, found a friend of mine. Out in the jungle, wandering around, in the rain, saying over and over, don't know enough to come in, out of the rain, don't know enough to come in, out of the rain, don't know enough, on and on like that, poor crazy bastard."
"Save your breath."
They ran. They all laughed. They reached the door of the Sun Dome laughing. Simmons yanked the door wide. "Hey!" he yelled. "Bring on the coffee and buns!"
There was no reply. They stepped through the door. The Sun Dome was empty and dark. There was no synthetic yellow sun floating in a high, gaseous whisper at the center of the blue ceiling. There was no food waiting. It was cold as a vault, and through 1,000 holes which had been newly punctured in the ceiling, water streamed. The rain fell down, soaking into the thick rugs and the heavy modern furniture, and splashing on the glass tables. The jungle was growing up like a moss in the room, on top of the bookcases and the divans. The rain slashed through the holes and fell upon the three men's faces. Pickard began to laugh quietly.
"Shut up, Pickard."
"Ye gods. Look what's here for us.
No food, no sun, nothing.
The Venusians?
They did it.
Of course."
Simmons nodded, with the rain funneling down on his face. The water ran in his silvered hair and on his white eyebrows.
"Every once in a while the Venusians come up out of the sea and attack a Sun Dome. They know if they can ruin the Sun Domes, they can ruin us."
"But aren't the Sun Domes protected with guns?"
"Sure."
Simmons stepped aside to a place that was relatively dry.
"But it's been 5 years since the Venusians tried anything. Defense relaxes. They caught this dome unaware."
"Where are the bodies?"
"The Venusians took them all down into the sea. I hear they have a delightful way of drowning you. It takes about 8 hours to drown the way they work it. Really delightful."
"I bet there isn't any food here at all," Pickard laughed. The lieutenant frowned at him, nodding at him so Simmons could see. Simmons shook his head and went back to a room at one side of the oval chamber. The kitchen was strewn with soggy loaves of bread and meat that had grown a faint green fur. Rain came through 100 holes in the kitchen roof.
"Brilliant."
The lieutenant glanced up at the holes. "I don't suppose we can plug up all those holes and get snug here."
"Without food, sir?" Simmons retorted. "I noticed the sun machine's torn apart. Our best bet is to make our way to the next Sun Dome. How far is that from here?"
"Not far. As I recall, they built two rather close together here. Perhaps if we waited here, a rescue mission from the other might..."
"It's probably been here and gone already, some days ago. They'll send a crew to repair this place in about 6 months, when they get the money from Congress. I don't think we'd better wait."
"All right, then. We'll eat what's left of our rations and get on to the next dome." Pickard said, "If only the rain wouldn't hit my head just for a few minutes. If I could only remember what it's like not to be bothered." He put his hands on his skull and held it tight. "I remember when I was in school, a bully used to sit in back of me and pinch me and pinch me and pinch me every 5 minutes, all day long. He did that for weeks and months. My arms were sore and black and blue all the time, and I thought I'd go crazy from being pinched. One day I must have gone a little mad from being hurt and hurt, and I turned around and took a metal trisquare I used in mechanical drawing, and I almost killed that bastard. I almost cut his lousy head off. I almost took his eye out before they dragged me out of the room, and I kept yelling, 'Why don't he leave me alone? Why don't he leave me alone? Brother!'" His hands clenched the bone of his head, shaking, tightening, his eyes shut. "But what do I do now? Who do I hit? Who do I tell to lay off? Stop bothering me. This damn rain? Like the pinching? Always on you. That's all you hear. That's all you feel."
"We'll be at the other Sun Dome by 4 this afternoon."
"Sun Dome? Look at this one! What if all the Sun Domes on Venus are gone? What then? What if there are holes in all the ceilings, and the rain coming in?"
"We'll have to chance it."
"I'm tired of chancing it. All I want is a roof and some quiet."
I want to be alone. That's only 8 hours off. If you hold on.
Don't worry.
I'll hold on, all right. And Pickard laughed, not looking at them.
Let's eat,
said Simmons, watching him. They set off down the coast, southward again. After 4 hours, they had to cut inland to go around a river that was a mile wide, and so swift it was not navigable by boat. They had to walk inland 6 miles to a place where the river boiled out of the earth, suddenly, like a mortal wound. In the rain, they walked on solid ground and returned to the sea.
I've got to sleep, said Pickard at last.
He slumped.
Haven't slept in 4 weeks. Tried, but couldn't. Sleep here.
The sky was getting darker. The night of Venus was setting in, and it was so completely black that it was dangerous to move. Simmons and the lieutenant fell to their knees also, and the lieutenant said, All right, we'll see what we can do. We've tried it before, but I don't know. Sleep doesn't seem one of the things you can get in this weather. They lay out full, propping their heads up so the water wouldn't come to their mouths, and they closed their eyes. The lieutenant twitched. He did not sleep. There were things that crawled on his skin. Things grew upon him in layers. Drops fell and touched other drops, and they became streams that trickled over his body, and while these moved down his flesh, the small growths of the forest took root in his clothing. He felt the ivy cling and make a second garment over him. He felt the small flowers bud and open and petal away, and still the rain pattered on his body and on his head. In the luminous night, for the vegetation glowed in the darkness, he could see the other two men outlined, like logs that had fallen and taken upon themselves velvet coverings of grass and flowers. The rain hit his face. He covered his face with his hands. The rain hit his neck. He turned over on his stomach in the mud, on the rubbery plants, and the rain hit his back and hit his legs. Suddenly he leaped up and began to brush the water from himself. 1,000 hands were touching him, and he no longer wanted to be touched. He no longer could stand being touched. He floundered and struck something else and knew that it was Simmons, standing up in the rain, sneezing moisture, coughing and choking, and then Pickard was up, shouting, running about. "Wait a minute, Pickard!" "Stop it! Stop it!" Pickard screamed. He fired off his gun 6 times at the night sky. In the flashes of powdery illumination, they could see armies of raindrops, suspended as in a vast, motionless amber.